Have you ever seen a really creepy targeted ad online? One that reveals just how much these companies know about your life?
Well, it's not just retailers who are tapping the advertising surveillance machine to get your data. It's also the government. Today, we'll be diving deeper into how targeted advertising can reveal your location to federal law enforcement. I'm Hudson Hongo.
And I'm Christian Romero. This is Effector from the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Later, we'll be talking to Syra Hussein, senior staff attorney at EFF, about a victory for protesters seeking to hold police accountable for unlawful digital searches.
We'll also be talking about a troubling conflict over the Department of Defense's use of AI and what it means for the future of mass surveillance.
But first, a newly uncovered document that confirms some of our worst suspicions about the online ad industry. So, I know we've talked about this before, Christian, but what was your creepiest targeted ad experience?
I mean, anytime I open Instagram, it's pretty creepy. It's just flooded with hoodies because I'm always looking at hoodies. So never a good time there.
They know you're a hoodie buyer. You buy a lot of hoodies. Some database somewhere, they just have Christian hooded sweatshirts.
Wearing one right now. I mean, come on. Of course.
So obviously that unnerving feeling is related to all the data we know that's being collected. But today we're going to be talking about one of the more specific insidious uses of that data, specifically location tracking by the government. To tell us more, we're joined by Lena Cohen, staff technologist at EFF. Thanks for joining us, Lena.
Hi, happy to be here.
So last week, 404 Media published this document from Customs and Border Protection, CBP, about their use of commercially obtained location data. What was significant about this document, Lena?
Yeah, so this document was a what's called a privacy threshold analysis. It's a type of record that DHS is required to complete when they're exploring a new technology. And it described a 2019 to 2021 pilot program where the DHS would use commercially available location data to track people's locations. And what was especially significant about this document is that it was the first time that the government had acknowledged that it was sourcing location data from the online advertising ecosystem, specifically real-time bidding. That's the technical system that powers most of these creepy targeted ads you see online.
So could you explain more, like, what is real-time bidding data?
Yeah, so real-time bidding is the process that determines the ads you see on nearly every website and app. The ads you see are the winners of milliseconds-long auctions that, unfortunately, expose your personal information to hundreds to thousands of companies a day. When you visit an app or a website with ad space, it will ask an ad tech company to determine which ad to display, and that involves sending information about you and the content you're viewing to hundreds, if not thousands, of potential advertisers. The ad tech company will package all the information they can gather about you into a bid request that can include some unique identifiers, your device details, your interests, like the fact that I hear Christian likes hooded sweatshirts, even your location data. So if an app has access to your location data, that data might be included in the bid request that's sent to hundreds of or thousands of potential advertisers. Anyone posing as an ad buyer can access a massive stream of personal data that's being broadcast about everyone who sees ads every day. So data brokers can and do eavesdrop on these real-time bidding auctions in order to collect data, including location data, about people who they have no interest in advertising to. They just want a a free source of personal data that they can sell.
So, right, once this data enters the online advertising ecosystem, it just kind of goes into this whole commercial space where it can be collected, bought, sold, and this can include, like you said, location data. Now, I know that the confirmation of the real-time bidding data is new, but we already did know about a few different agencies that were using commercial location data, right?
Yeah, definitely. We knew that ICE, CBP, and the FBI had purchased location data from a data broker called Ventel and used it to identify immigrants who were later arrested. And even though we didn't know exactly the source of Ventel's data, their parent company, Gravy Analytics, suffered a data breach last year that exposed some of the apps that they may have been collecting data from. There were thousands of apps referenced in that data breach, including Candy Crush, Tinder, Grindr, pregnancy trackers, religious-focused apps. And, you know, experts who looked at the breached data, even at the time, suggested that much of the data was likely collected through real-time bidding, through these online advertising auctions, even beyond, you know, the government directly purchasing location data from a data broker. We've known about the government purchasing a spy tool called, a surveillance tool called Weblock, which makes it easy to visualize some of this commercially available location data. You know, law enforcement agents can draw shape on a map and see identifiers for a bunch of phones that have passed through that geographic area in a certain period of time. And they can, you know, select one of those phones and see its location history over time. A lot of these tools or data brokers claim that location data is anonymous or collected with consent. But you can't really anonymize location data, because if you see where someone's sleeping, where they work, where they pick up their kids from school, it's really easy to figure out who that person is.
So a lot of this kind of makes me want to faceplant into my desk or just like run through a wall because it sounds so terrible. But I know one of the things we like to focus on is giving people tools or tips to protect themselves online. Do you have any thoughts on what people can do to protect themselves from some of this data tracking and collection?
Definitely. It's not your fault that the advertising industry has built this massive surveillance machine that can easily be co-opted by the government. The burden shouldn't fall on individuals to protect their location data every time they use their phone. Privacy should be the default, but in the meantime, there are some steps you can take to limit how much data and location data you're sharing with other companies. First of all, if you haven't already, I recommend disabling your mobile advertising ID. That's, you know, a unique identifier associated with your phone that data brokers use to stitch together the information they collect about you on different apps. If you have an iPhone, you've probably done this already. That's disabling your advertising ID is what happens when you ask apps not to track you. Apple, you know, sends you those pop-ups before sharing your advertising ID. If you have an Android, your advertising ID is shared by default, so you definitely want to make sure to change that setting. You should also review the apps you've granted location permissions to, because if an app has access to your location, it could share it with other companies. Maybe an app developer isn't intentionally sending your location to a data broker or another company, but the advertising tool that they've built into their app is automatically harvesting your location data if you've granted the app access to it. So be careful about the apps you share your location data with. Turn off your advertising ID And if you're traveling to a sensitive location and you want a stronger security plan, there are more extreme steps you should probably take. And EFF has a guide to protecting your location data that you should reference. But the two steps I outlined are, they're easy, they're fast, and they'll make it a little bit harder for location data brokers to access your information.
So, like you said, it's not people's fault that all of these companies are sucking up their data and sending it into this dark ecosystem. There's a role that tech companies need to be playing here, right?
Definitely. Tech companies have built this surveillance system that the government is using to violate people's rights. So tech companies and advertising companies specifically really need to reckon with their role in building a warrantless government surveillance system. I think that, first of all, EFF has been advocating for years for a ban on online behavioral advertising and a switch to contextual advertising. That means not targeting ads based on these detailed behavioral profiles that tech companies have built about us, but instead just targeting ads based on the content of an app or a website that the ad will be on. I think that short of switching to a privacy-respecting contextual advertising system, tech companies can still make changes to limit the use of advertising systems for government location tracking. First of all, precise location data should never be broadcast through these online advertising auctions, through these real-time bidding systems. Ads can still be targeted generally to, the city someone is in without exposing people's exact location to data brokers and tech companies. This location data is so sensitive that it just should never be broadcast to the hundreds or thousands of unvetted companies who are participating in constant advertising auctions. Location data can reveal where we work, where we live, where we protest, where we worship. It's the sort of sensitive data that needs to be protected by default. Second of all, tech companies, big tech companies like Apple and Google created these advertising IDs that have become the linchpin of the data broker economy, and they should remove ad IDs from devices or, at a minimum, disable them by default. That's not a crazy, unrealistic idea. Advertising IDs weren't added to phones until 2012, and Apple disabled them by default starting in 2021. And, when Apple actually gave people the choice of whether or not they wanted to share this unique and trackable identifier with companies, about 96% of users opted out. So when given an easy choice, people make it clear that they don't want to be tracked. And Google should follow Apple's lead and give people that choice.
Yeah, I mean, when you spell it out as in, like, this company is tracking you, do you want to stop that? It's very easy for someone to be like, yeah, absolutely not. That sounds horrible. you listed out, I think, one or two things that lawmakers could do. Is there anything else that EFF is pushing them to do to stop some of this stuff that's happening, this terrible stuff?
Yeah, we need a strong federal privacy law to make to stop companies from harvesting and selling our personal information every time we use the web. EFF has been advocating for years for this type of legislation, and it's important that data privacy legislation includes, a strong enforcement mechanism and doesn't give companies an easy way out by you know, burying creepy practices in terms of service that no one actually reads. Basically, it's important that data privacy law protects people's privacy and not tech companies' business models. So second, legislators really need to close the data broker loophole of the Fourth Amendment. Instead of getting a warrant, we'll often see law enforcement agencies just buying data from location data brokers to find out where people have been. And we really need to pass legislation. EFF has advocated for legislation like the Fourth Amendment is not for sale act to stop law enforcement from just buying information that they normally need a warrant to obtain.
It's a really, in my opinion, sensible sort of policy, right? Like right now we have this world where any kind of law enforcement can basically just, yeah, sidestep the Fourth Amendment, this requirement for a warrant to get people's information by just going into this shadowy market and just buying what's out there for sale.
Yeah, I mean, it's common sense. It also could and should be bipartisan. I mean, Montana became the first state in the U.S. to pass a law addressing this data broker loophole. They passed a law last year blocking the government from buying sensitive data that it would otherwise need a warrant to obtain.
Well, thanks again, Lena. A really horrifying situation and information to learn more about, but I'm glad that you also offered us a few intervention solutions that we can take on an individual and, importantly, a legislative level to address them. So, as I said earlier, we recently saw a great decision for protesters out of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. To unpack this, I talked with our colleague, Syra Hussain. Let's listen. Well, hi, Syra. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So today we're talking about a court decision that you called a big win for protester rights. To start with, what is this a case about at its core?
The case is about our right to privacy in our digital devices, our electronic devices and our digital data. And really, it's about the Fourth Amendment right as it extends to protesters.
So can you tell me a little bit about what happened in 2021 that spurred this lawsuit?
Well, the facts of this case are super interesting. In 2021, there was a housing protest that took place. And I'm going to back up a little bit because before you get to the housing protest, I think that the court in this case did a really nice job of setting up what happened. There were some really significant tensions between law enforcement and community in the wake of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. And that extended to places all around the country, including here in the city of Colorado Springs. And so the court teased this up really nicely by identifying some of the animus that officers may have had against protesters at the very outset, you know, saying things like, we should basically threatening bodily harm against protesters. And so they said that this was based on the allegations of the plaintiffs. And I thought that was really important to talk about leading up to exactly how this case unfolded. So now going back to the protest, there was a housing rights protest in 2021. And there are people who were engaged in civil disobedience. They were blocking a roadway. Police told them to get off the roadway. They got off the roadway. And then many of them were arrested for obstructing the roadway. Typical civil disobedience. But thereafter, this is kind of where it starts to go a little bit off the rails. Law enforcement thereafter started looking into individuals who were involved in the protest, and they really honed in on one person named Jacqueline Armendariz. She came to the protest. She had a bike with her. After the protest, police alleged that she tried to throw the bike at them during the protest. She alleges that she dropped the bike as an officer was running towards her, and actually the officer ran past her to accost somebody else. And based on that, they ended up applying for a few different search warrants. One was for Armendariz's devices. And this was based on allegations that protesters carry electronic devices with them when they're protesting. And so we believe that we should be able to search her devices related to this alleged bike throwing incident. And then they also sought a warrant not just to seize the devices, but also to search them, including a 2-month search of, like, basically what you think about is generally the place where you'd search for things on a phone, like through email, through text messages, through photos, for, you know, allegedly related to this incident. And they also sought a time unlimited keyword search of 26 words as broad as bike, assault, celebration, and right. And, you know, you think about this and you're like, wow, that's a lot of information that they're seeking for allegedly throwing a bike at a cop. And lo and behold, the magistrate signed off on these warrants. So they ended up arresting Armin Darez for this alleged assault. They seized 6 of her devices, 3 cell phones, 2 laptops, and an external hard drive. And then they conducted these searches. Separately, law enforcement also obtained a warrant for the Facebook page related to the Chinook Center, which was the organization that spearheaded this protest. And they sought basically a week's worth of communications that the Chinook Center may have had with other individuals, sort of their engagement with others. It really was very broad, especially since the Chinook Center had never been accused of any sort of crime. And lo and behold, the magistrate also signed off on that. So that's those are the facts that are underlying this case.
Those are quite the facts. So after this, right, the activists sued the city of Colorado Springs, correct?
That's right. They sued under a 1983 action, which is basically saying you violated our civil rights, you violated our Fourth Amendment rights against unlawful search and seizure. And they argued that the warrant was very broad and was not sufficiently particularized as was required of warrants. The district court judge said, actually, the warrants were fine, and also said, and in any case, even if they weren't fine, officers are entitled to qualified immunity. This is the doctrine that attorneys and a lot of the general public hate, because what it does is it effectively lets law enforcement off the hook, oftentimes for really bad acts. Qualified immunity has often prevented officers from being held liable for providing, like, medical care for people who are in prison for use of excessive force. Because what it says is that if you have to first inquire as to whether there was a constitutional right that was violated, and if there was that right, was the right quote unquote clearly established? So this has been used many times by courts to be like, oh, there was this horrible thing that happened, but you know what? The officers aren't liable because the right wasn't clearly established. And so we run into this over and over again. We have a blog post from several years back about why EFF hates qualified immunity. And oftentimes it's because we're trying to make new law, right, around, like, the search of your digital data and your devices. And sometimes courts are not, you know, haven't necessarily considered the specific issue we brought because of novel questions. So it's something that we come up against, and many others in our spaces come up against as well. And so the plaintiffs in this case, you know, were handed that loss at the district court level, and then they appealed to the Tenth Circuit.
Which we supported that appeal in our amicus brief. What did we want the appeals court to understand?
So we drafted an amicus brief that was joined by the Center for Democracy and Technology, the Electronic Privacy Information Center at EPIC, and the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. And we wrote this amicus brief basically saying these warrants were very general. These were not particularized warrants, and the amount of information that you can glean from somebody's electronic devices is just huge. You know, far more, oftentimes we talk about this in the context of the border search, but, you know, far more than what you can glean from luggage. It's basically a whole, paints a tapestry of your life. And so the amount of information that the officers could get from these devices and the searches that they were authorized to do were very, very broad. We also spoke about how when the Fourth Amendment encounters the First Amendment, where there's First Amendment rights at stake, as they were here with protesters, the Fourth Amendment must be applied with quote-unquote scrupulous exactitude. That comes from a Supreme Court decision. And what that means is that when there are First Amendment rights at stake, courts have to very carefully consider what the warrant is authorizing officers to do and consider whether that may affect people's expressive and associational rights.
So what did the appeals court ultimately find last month?
So the appeals court did something that we, you know, we don't see often. What the court did was it overturned the district court's dismissal of the lawsuit related to the Fourth Amendment search and seizure claims. And the court actually said, you know what, this is about the warrants. Let's look at each and every warrant and let's analyze those details. So they did. They went through each of the three warrants that were sought by law enforcement, and they said these warrants were facially deficient, basically. The first thing that they said was that when it came to the seizure of the devices, they said, you know, there was no real nexus between the seizure of the devices and the investigation that was happening here, which was related to the bike throwing. And we raised this in our amicus brief as well. But, you know, it's the type of crime that was at issue here, or the alleged crime that was at issue here, was bike throwing. Why would electronic devices need to be searched? And they spoke about how there were all these cursory allegations in the affidavits to the warrants saying protesters carry cell phones with them. Protesters sometimes take photos when they're at protests, things like that, that were just super general. And they said that there's not a sufficient nexus between the alleged crime being investigated and the seizure of these devices. They also then went into each of the searches and they said, you know, these searches for 26 keywords were so broad and time unbounded that they could uncover all kinds of information. They also looked into the file searches, like the photos, emails, text messages, things like that. And they, you know, again, said that this was a very broad search and lacked a nexus to the crime that was being investigated here. And then they also went to the Chinook Center's Facebook warrant, and they identified a lot of the deficiencies, same deficiencies there. So they first said, you know, that these warrants were facially deficient. Oftentimes the inquiry ends there, because even if the warrants are facially deficient, sometimes courts say, oh, but the magistrate signed off on it, so officers can't be held liable because they, you know, it should have been the magistrate that was the sort of backstop. And here, the court went beyond that. They said that the officer should have known that the warrants were so facially deficient that even if a magistrate signed off on it, they shouldn't have executed that warrant because it didn't meet the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. That is really rare. And that's why we think it's such a big win. And so what the court held was that not only was there a constitutional right that was violated, but that the officers were not entitled to qualified immunity for these violations. This happened, remember, on a motion to dismiss. So what that means is that the lower court dismissed the case without sort of any, just based on the basis of the complaint itself. So just on the basis of the lawsuit. And so what happens now is the 10th Circuit has remanded, with this opinion, has remanded this case back down to the district court to allow the case to proceed. So it's not over. There's more that's going to come, but this is such a significant step forward in terms of vindicating the rights of protesters and really all of us in terms of our right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure in our electronic devices and our digital data.
So I know the core events we're talking about happened a few years ago, but to me, at least, it feels like the issues in this case are particularly relevant now. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we are seeing people all over the country right now, and particularly in places like Minneapolis and Portland, in Los Angeles, people who are taking out their phones and they're recording ICE as ICE is conducting these roving immigration raids in neighborhoods. Engaging in excessive force, engaging in unconstitutional actions. and people are engaging in their right to record and in their right to protest these actions. And so this decision seems especially salient in this day and age because of everything that we're seeing around the country and law enforcement's and particularly ICE's, very heavy hand in how they're responding to people exercising their First Amendment rights. So this case definitely does have a bearing on what's happening in this day and age.
Are there any other points we should take away from all this?
I just want to say that it is so rare to see a court come down on this issue in such a strong and well-reasoned manner. Oftentimes what we see is there's all of this deference that's granted to law enforcement when it comes to, applying for search warrants and to magistrates that sign off on these deficient search warrants. And so it's amazing to see the 10th Circuit say, you know what? There was a mistake here. And it wasn't just a mistake on the part of the magistrate for authorizing those warrants. There was also a significant and clear mistake from the officers for even pursuing these warrants in the first place. That's a big one.
Great. Well, thanks again for stopping by, Syra.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Hudson. This one's quite the saga, quite the doozy. So have you kept up on the Department of Defense's dispute with Anthropic?
I have done my best to keep up with the Department of Defense's dispute with Anthropic. So important context. Today, we're recording today on Monday, March 9th. Who knows what's going to happen in the 2 days before this goes up. But basically, if you have not been paying attention to this at all, the AI company Anthropic was in negotiations with the Pentagon over the contract that the military has to use their AI systems. There was a sticking point over the use of that AI for mass surveillance and autonomous weapons, which Anthropic didn't want. Pentagon didn't like that Anthropic didn't want it, and it blew up into this incredible saga, as you mentioned, Christian, where Pentagon has broken up with Anthropic, now best friends with OpenAI. As I understand it, they still may be using Anthropic products as recently as the bombing of Iran. But in any case, right, since then, OpenAI has a deal with the Pentagon now, which they have assured people, weirdly, has the same red lines as Anthropic laid out, which doesn't make any sense to any reasonable person. Why would the Pentagon get pissed at Anthropic over these red lines that it would then agree to with OpenAI? And since then, we've seen parts of the contract, which make it clear the difference between these the desired Anthropic agreement and the one that OpenAI signed are. And what else has happened? You know, the government blacklisted Anthropic. I think as of today, Anthropic is suing over this. Is that all? Do you have anything else to add, Christian?
You've done a fantastic job. I think you deserve an award because even I learned a little bit from your summary. And I was reading this like an hour ago just to be like, dude, did I catch everything? And no, I didn't. Thankfully, our colleague Matt Gariglia has been writing a bunch of blog posts about this. He's been keeping us up to date.
I mean, so there's a lot of different aspects of this story, different things to unpack. But what I liked about some of the blogs that Matt wrote was they underlined the important part of this when it comes to our rights, right? So one of these red lines was about mass surveillance. And Anthropic wanted the Pentagon to agree to one thing. They would not. Eventually, the Pentagon made a different deal with OpenAI over the same subject. And it's like really obvious that this is a story about control of our rights, right? Like, I don't know about you, but to me, it's a little bit disturbing. The question of whether AI is being used to mass surveil us is a contract dispute between these giant tech companies and the Department of Defense. I don't know. I feel like if I was living in a democratic society, there are different ways I would want the protection of my civil liberties to be decided.
Yeah, it's not just the jank idea that like a tech company CEO can like have so much sway in what happens to our civil liberties and human rights, but like also the fact that this is just like a massively weird and awkward breakup happening essentially on social media, like in a weird way, is not comforting to me at all. But yeah, Matt's blog post with the headline, "Privacy protection shouldn't depend on the decisions of a few powerful people," hits the nail on the head, which is like, you know, contracts and CEOs and random people in the government shouldn't be it's not sustainable for them to be deciding how our rights play out. So, you know, especially when CEOs just sometimes have our best interests in mind, like, you know, Matt comes down on, we need laws that protect our privacy. And we've been pushing for a strong privacy law for forever at this point. So.
Right. And I think on this issue specifically about mass surveillance and the use of technology, Lena talked about it earlier, right? There's this huge loophole for the for data that's been bought on the commercial market. The Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act, which was passed by the House in 2024 and then failed in the Senate. Like, that's like what this is about, is, oh, obviously it's lawmakers that should be protecting our rights, right? Not just the whims of strange people. You mentioned the bizarre way it's played out on social media, which is sort of like downstream of the fact that this is, oh, bizarrely personality driven, right? The actual, like, you know, three or four human beings who just have different feelings about each other and about what should be done are deciding how this technology is going to be deployed.
Yeah. And it's worse that, like, you know, OpenAI signs the contract with the Pentagon, and then they have a massive fallout. A bunch of users like start to leave the platform or delete the app. Claude like shoots up in the app store because people are like moving to Claude because OpenAI makes ChatGPT and people are mad at OpenAI. And then that's when OpenAI decides like, oh, we're going to amend our contract because the people don't like it. I hate that is the thing that makes you go, oh, actually, we should care about our users. We should care about the American people. Right.
And I think not just our colleagues, but a lot of people have honed in on the exact language that OpenAI made public from the contract, which I'm going to read here. Consistent with applicable laws, including the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, National Security Act of 1947, and FISA Act of 1978, the AI systems shall not be intentionally used for domestic surveillance of U.S. persons and nationals. So there's like a lot of really key words in there that are doing a lot of work, right?
It shall not be intentionally used. You know, we could not realize that it's being used, and that's fine, but like intentionally.
Right. I mean, which is, this isn't the first time we've been talking about the U.S. government and mass surveillance and how they understand the law to work, right? With everything around NSA spying, we learned exactly where the U.S. government drew the law with like, oh, what's intentional, targeted versus incidental. And then the other really key wording there, consistent with applicable laws, right? It's not like not like we won't do it. It's not like, oh, we are going to make sure that it doesn't happen. It's just, oh, as long as it's legal, right? And legal according to who becomes a really important question.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when you think about everything we've talked about today, you know?
Yeah, all kinds of totally, at a civil liberties level, unacceptable kinds of mass surveillance are effectively legal until they're properly challenged or, you know, legislated out of the law. Well, hopefully that's as up to date as we can be. So many, who knows, in the 2 days before this goes up, it feels like almost anything could happen, which is kind of the case when these things aren't decided by the public, right? Or through legislation, but just four strangers. Four strangers who have different feelings, and what they decide is what you get. Not how I would run a society, not how we should run a society. And now, events. Christian, what opportunities to connect with EFF are coming up?
Yeah, for this month's Affecting Change live stream, we're sitting down with 404 Media co-founder Jason Kepler and Cindy Cohen to discuss Cindy's new book, Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance. You can join us on Thursday, March 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific. Next, you can catch EFF at B-Sides San Francisco on March 21st and 22nd. We're going to have a membership table, an Ask EFF panel, and a few other talks, so be sure to check them out if you're attending. And finally, we're attending CypherCon in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on April 1st and 2nd. We're presenting one of the keynotes, and we'll also have a membership table, so be sure to stop by with all of your burning digital rights questions. Of course, you can also learn about all these events and other ways to see EFF at eff.org/events.
Thanks, Christian. Well, that's it for this week's Effector. Effector is a podcast by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the leading nonprofit defending online civil liberties. Our theme music is I Dunno by Grapes.
EFF promotes digital innovation, defends free speech, fights illegal surveillance, and protects rights and freedoms for all. Become an EFF member today at eff.org/podfan.